Hello and welcome to the game production community. Today we're hosting a playtesting masterclass featuring game industry veteran, games user research consultant, author of the How to Be a Games User Researcher book, and most recently creator of the Playtest Kit, Steve Bromley. Over the course of the session, Steve will offer solutions to many of the barriers to regular playtesting, such as, where can I find playtesters? When should I run a playtest? And how should I have feedback? There will be a live Q&A after, so feel free to vote for questions and post your own in the event QA channel. In the meantime, we'd love for you to share your thoughts in the event chat channel and engage with each other along the way. Please note that this session will be recorded and published on the Game Production Podcast as soon as we're able. I must thank our wonderful supporters and in particular our event producer Angelo for making this event happen. And with that, I would like to hand the stage, well, in this case, the voice channel, to Steve.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. And thank you everyone for joining today. So today we're going to talk about playtesting, which is a subject that's really, I'm really enthusiastic about, and I'm really happy to be able to share this stuff with you. A bit about my background and why I'm here today talking about playtesting. So I am a user researcher working in games. You might be familiar with user researchers, but the idea is we plan and run playtest studies all day for a variety of game teams. I started with a team at PlayStation for the first 5 years of my career, which is a really nice place to learn how to be a games user researcher. PlayStation, as a publisher, obviously have a huge variety of studios, from huge ones like Horizon to tiny teams working on small PlayStation Vita games. And you get a great understanding of the range of playtesting experiences and the types of things that you need to deal with from that. I left PlayStation about 5 years ago. Since then, I've been working with a variety of game team sizes, from small indies to AAA studios, to run playtests and help them establish user research as a function. I also set up a mentoring scheme for games research and people who wanted to do playtesting and games user research as a full-time career. And that led into, as Junie mentioned, the book that I released last year called How to Be a Games User Researcher, which explains what's a career in games user research look like, what skills do you need, how do you go about getting those skills. I've also spent a lot of this year, and the topic of what we'll be talking about today is trying to make playtesting accessible to every other game developer. Not everyone has the ability to spend all day, every day, running user research and running playtests. And one of the challenges that we want to cover today is how do you make playtesting and user research accessible to teams who don't have dedicated user researchers or UX people and just have to do it as part of their job, which is what I'm going to talk about today. So whenever I talk about playtesting, no one's against the idea, and everyone on this call recognises playtesting is a good thing to do and would say, yes, I love playtesting. I think it's really important. It's well understood in game development that iteration is the way that you find fun, that you finesse your ideas, and the more iteration you can do, the higher quality of the game that you're making at launch. And playtesting is one of those things that inspires that iteration by looking at what players understand, what players can do, what players are finding difficult. You come up with a lot of inspiration for where you should be putting your attention and where iteration should be happening. So no one's against playtesting as an idea, but it doesn't happen as much as you think it would or as much as people want to be doing it. Because user research and playtesting takes a whole bunch of time, takes a whole bunch of money to do, teams aren't in the position where they can regularly do playtests or run the number of playtests or user research studies that they want to be doing. As a problem, that really interests me and something that I wanted to explore deeper. And so I spent a lot of last year interviewing people who have to run playtests, but it's not their full-time job. So leaving that user research community behind. And I started to interview solo devs, designers, UX people, producers, community managers, QA people, lots of people who just have to run playtests as their job or want to be running playtests. And I wanted to understand, what is it that makes playtesting difficult? What are the bits that mean you can't run them as often as you want to? And what are some of the challenges that we can fix to try and make user research and playtesting more accessible to all of our teams? What I heard from the session is playtesting is hard. There's difficulties finding participants, there's difficulties working out when you should playtest, there's difficulties working out how to handle all the playtest data. And as UXers and user researchers, we think we have the answers to some of those problems because we're running user research all the time. It's our day jobs and we do it every day. We've hit the same roadblocks and we've worked out what's the best way of overcoming it or what can you do about it. But what I want to achieve today is start to explain some of that, to share what we've learned from the user research community and the UX community to teams who just have to run playtests, who aren't going to be dedicated user researchers. So that's what we're going to cover today, 5 lessons about what's hard about playtesting and what we can do to make it easier. And we're going to frame all of this around the playtest process. So regardless of whether you're a big team doing hundreds of playtests or you're just a solo dev doing your first playtest, you're likely to go through some steps where you're planning, where you're working out, what do we need to playtest? Are we ready for a playtest? Going through some preparation stages where you want to identify what's the right method we're going to use, getting the build ready, designing the tasks and the things you're going to ask. Then you're going to do some sort of data collection. That might be interviews or watching people play or reading survey responses, but getting back the raw data from your participants. And then you're going to decide to take an action. You've learned something about your game. You need to decide, what are we going to do about what we've learned from our game? At the end, I'll share a checklist version of this just so you have it if it's helpful, where you can see what are the steps that people usually go through when they're doing a playtest. But our focus today is 5 specific areas of that playtest process. First, we're going to talk about the challenges of finding high-quality playtesters and how you can go about finding those playtesters. Next, we're going to talk about working out the right time to playtest. When is it's the right moment to run your first playtest? When should you run your next playtest after that? Then we're going to look at how do you make the most of your players' time? Once you've got some people committed to playtesting, what are you actually going to do with them? And what can we do that gets the most value from that playtest we're going to run? Playtesting generates a huge amount of data. We're going to look at how to handle that data and what we can do with it. And last of all, we're going to talk about deciding what to do next. You've learned something about your game. You've learned some problems or some things you need to work on. How do we decide what we're going to do about them? On the playtest process, that looks something like this. So we'll talk about deciding the focus of your playtest. We'll talk about the appropriate research methods. We're going to start with talking about recruiting playtesters for reasons that I'll explain in a second. We're going to talk about that step about analysing the raw data, and we'll talk about turning your conclusions into actions. Although, because we've only got an hour together today, we won't get to touch on all those other topics which are equally important for playtesting. So first of all, I wanted to talk about how do you find high-quality playtesters? During those interviews that I had with game designers and developers, I asked them, how do you currently find your playtesters? What was very common was the idea of, we just use whatever's convenient. We might ask our friends and family because they're around. If some teams had links with other game developers, either game development communities or university game development courses, and they would ask them to playtest their games and give them feedback. Others, they would ask their community. They would have some existing fans who enjoyed their game and played their game and ask them to playtest their game. Unfortunately, as user researchers, we know there are some challenges with using these types of users. Often they're very different from the type of people who are going to buy your game at the end. They know more about the game than a typical player would. If they're a game developer, they're coming at it with their game development experience and their game development expertise. If they're your friends, they've heard you talk about the game and they know what you think the vision of the game is. If they're your existing community, they know they've been following the development of the game and they know a lot of things that a regular player wouldn't know. Because of this, their opinions are different from a typical player, their behavior is different, and it all wraps up into their feedback is going to be different from the feedback of a genuine player who will play your game. And that's going to be a challenge. That means that when we playtest, although we're learning, we're hearing some feedback, we're learning some things, we're not confident this actually represents the feedback and the behaviour and the views of the real people who are going to buy our game. And some of the stories I heard from game developers showed some of the problems with that. For example, just using your existing community to balance the difficulty of your game leads to games that are much too hard and intimidating for new players. That's a problem and something that we want to talk about how to fix today. Which brings me to my first fix I wanted to cover today, which is the idea of creating a pool of playtesters that you can call upon whenever you need to run a playtest. In the user research community, we call this a panel, a group of participants who are ready to take part in playtests when you need them. And it, although it is some upfront work, it's the type of thing that once you put in half a day's of upfront work to prepare and do this, it pays off throughout that game development process. Every time you need to run a playtest, you've got a group of people ready. It's not that much effort to refresh it or to build upon it. And so it is one of those tasks that creates enormous value as you run more and more playtests later down the road. And the steps we're going to talk about for finding those playtesters is, first of all, defining our target players, working out where we're going to keep them once we've got them, creating an incentive, a reason why they want to take part in your test, finding where those players are and getting hold of them for this, and then working out how to convince them to take part. So first of all, the idea of defining your target player. We talked about why game developers, why your friends are not suitable, so we need to define who a suitable playtester is. What we know about our playtesters is, what we know about the people who are going to buy our game is they're going to buy our game. That probably means they also buy and play similar games to our games, and that's enough that we can start to define them. We could think about someone who's going to play my game. What other games do I think they're going to play? Start to list them out. We could think about where are they going to be buying games? What's their process for buying games? If you're making a game that's advertised on Steam, your target player will be people who buy games from Steam. Whereas if your game is on itch.io, for example, again, what you know about your players is they're the type of person who looks for games on itch.io. From this, you can start to define your players by saying, well, I know what games they play, and I know where they buy games from. And in a minute, we'll be using that information to work out where to find them. What we recommend, though, is not basing that definition on demographics. A trap I see teams falling into is saying, well, I think my player's about 18 years old or 18 to 25. I think they're male. I think they are they're based in the United States, which might all be true, but isn't helpful for us tracking down our players and finding them, and also can quickly lead to stereotyping. I think these days, the actual type of people who play games are a lot broader than people imagine. And so avoiding demographics is a great way to make sure that we are targeting on recruitment criteria that's actually important rather than falling into those stereotypes. Okay, so we've thought about who are our players and what other games do they play. The next thing to do to create this pool of playtesters is we need a place to keep them once we've got hold of them. My recommendation is creating a playtest mailing list. There are tools like MailChimp or ConvertKit, which are free until you hit 1,000 users, I think. And mailing lists are very reliable ways of keeping hold of players. Unlike the idea of pushing them to Twitter or your social media account, or even Discord, these days people are on so many Discords and follow so many accounts, and with things like Twitter or Facebook or Instagram, you're beholden to the algorithm deciding whether it's going to tell them about your playtest or not. The most reliable way to get hold of people is by email. So the next step, create a blank mailing list where we're going to put these players once we have them. So we have defined who our players are. We know they're people who play similar games to ours, and we've decided where we're going to keep them. We've made a blank mailing list that currently has no one on it. Next, we need to think about what can we offer them to make them take part in playtests. This depends on your resources and what you have available. Obviously, if you are a big studio somewhere like PlayStation, you have money and you can give playtesters money to take part in your playtests. But for a lot of teams, that isn't feasible. Obviously, we're all tight on money. We can't give away money to playtests all day. And instead, we need to be more creative about thinking, what do we have that has value to our players that we can offer them to take part in our playtest? One thing you could look at is recognition, whether that is a special role on Discord, credits in the game, naming characters after them in the game. There are ways you can explore giving them recognition for what they're doing, which is valuable to some. Something that I've seen that's been very successful is partnering with other studios who are similar to yours and coming up with offering keys for games. What you can do with your partner studios is all offer to share keys to playtesters. And then when someone signs up to take partner playtests, you can offer them a choice of, you can have a key from any one of these five or so games for taking part in our playtest. What's quite nice about that is because you're offering a range of keys, you are avoiding biasing your group based on what you're offering, because you're offering a variety of games and attracting a variety of players based on that. This bit takes some work, though. If you do have money, it's a great place to spend money. But without money, you have to be creative in thinking, what can we offer our players to take part in our playtest? If you don't offer anything, the problem is you're only going to get people who would do this for free. And again, that's a huge bias. You're only going to get your friends, or you're only going to get people who like you personally to take part if you're not offering anything to take part in a playtest. Next, we need to find these players. And this is often the most difficult step. As we talked about earlier, we know something about those players. We know they play other similar games currently. What we want to do is find their communities or their watering holes. Where are these players hanging out currently and talking about games? Sometimes that might be obvious. If their competitor games have subreddits, you might look on Reddit for a competitor game and you found a whole bunch of people who might play your game. But if you've got no idea, Google often turns up great places to look. If you type in the name of the competitor game and then just some added keywords, for example, help, forum, question, community, it turns up all these obscure internet forums where people are talking about your competitor game. And because we know people who play your competitor game might also play your game, these are the type of people who might take part in your playtest. I really like help as a thing to search for, because people asking for help for a competitor game, they're likely not to be an extremely hardcore player who plays a huge amount and is an expert player. People asking for help are more likely to be a typical player, and that's really valuable, finding those typical players for your playtests. Some other creative ways to think about your community or where to find them is thinking about the USP, the unique selling point of your game. What's special about your game? And then think about whether that reveals any non-game communities you might want to approach. So as well as competitor games, you might want to look at, if you're making a music game, where do people who are interested in music hang out? They might be interested in a game. Let's go find them there. If you've got user-generated content, there are communities for user-generated content people. If your game's got dinosaurs in, you might find a community about people who care about dinosaurs. All of these are great places to look. And of course, there are also generic places to look. There are game development there are playtest forums to start off with, like Reddit's r/playtesting forum or Reddit's Destroy My Game, I think it's Destroy My Game forum, where people offer playtesting. They're slightly risky because they're usually frequented by only other game devs, which again, as we talked about, means you're only getting feedback from other game devs, and game devs aren't like your other players. There are, however, other subreddits that aren't only game devs, like generic work for hire communities or those community ones, where you might be able to find appropriate players. Or you can look in offline places, arcades, coffee shops, university campuses, places where typical players hang out. If you do go broader with these playtesting recruitments, though, you want to make sure they are your right type of player. The good thing about the communities for competitor games is you're already pretty sure they're the right type of player. But if you're going really broad, like you're going for a generic game dev community or a work for hire community, or you're going around coffee shops, you want to check that they're your right type of player by asking them some questions before they take part. This all adds up to the last thing. We've worked out where they are. We've worked out who they are. How do we convince them to take part? And again, this is an iterative thing that we need to work on. We need to start by writing a post, writing a description saying, why do you want to take part in this playtest? highlighting the USP of your game and what's interesting and compelling, highlighting the incentive if you're able to offer a code for another game or offer recognition such as credits. And all of that, you want to create an offer that says, please join my mailing list to take part in playtests in the future and sign them up to that playtest mailing list. This is an iterative thing. The first go at it, you'll work out, you can look at people's responses, see what people are saying about it, whether they're rejecting your offer, and then iterate when you join the next community to share it with that group. What you get at the end of this is you end up with a mailing list full of people who are ready to take part in playtests. And then when you're coming to run any individual playtest, it gets a lot easier. You can use calendar tools such as Calendly is one, where you just open up slots for playtests and you can just email your mailing list to say, we've opened up 5 slots for playtests, come and join us. And they book their own slots using those tools. Or if you're doing some sort of remote method where you just want a survey or just want them to do something in their own time, you can mail that mailing list directly. Ultimately, recruitment is one of the more challenging steps for playtesting. If you're a studio that has a huge amount of money, this is the type of thing you might want to outsource. And there are participant recruitment companies who handle all of this. But a lot of the teams I work with don't have the money to outsource this, which is why this process of setting up a panel, I think, is really important. And the reason it's really important is because if you fail to do this, if it doesn't work, all the other steps of playtesting are affected. If you're not finding the right participants, you're going to get irrelevant feedback, things that don't represent what your real players think. And it's going to be a lot more challenging to get any value from your playtesting process. So I appreciate I went in quite some detail about finding the right type of players, which I think is really important. But that wasn't the only challenge I heard from the developers I was interviewing about the playtesting process. Second challenge is working out the right time to playtest. In those chats, I heard so many reasons why people put off playtesting. They might think the game's not ready yet, I need to wait until I've got a vertical slice. They might assume that players are going to understand it, it's fine. They might think, oh, okay, I should wait until the final graphics are in and it's no point playtesting until that. But playtesting, as we talked about, is an iterative process. The longer we wait, the team's focus will move on and they'll stop paying attention to those things that they've just built. It'll be harder for us to make changes because some of the decisions they've made have been bedded in. And also it just reduces the number of iterations we do in that game. Rather than being on that red line where we're getting better and better each month, we are stuck on that blue line where the game is the same as it currently will be, and we're not doing the amount of iteration. Ultimately, this leads to underwhelming launches. You're going to find out those problems whether you playtest or not, but the decision you have to make is, do I want to find those problems before launch when I've got time to deal with it, or will I read them in my Metacritic reviews or on Steam reviews or after the game launches? So because of this challenge, the second thing I want to talk about is how do we identify those most important things to test early enough that we can do something about them? And the model that I talk to game teams about for understanding this is to recognize that every decision they're making in that game design process generates a hypothesis. Whether you're deciding what the game should look like or what the game should do, you have some assumptions about what players will understand, what players will be able to do, and how players will experience this feature. The first step then is to look at the decisions the team are currently making, regularly reflect on what are we working on, and from that generate some hypotheses about what do we expect players to do or what do we expect players to understand. And this can look a bit like this, where we have a hypothesis log saying, we think players will do something because of this game design feature. So for example, we think players will know what their health is because the UI cues are sufficient to indicate when they're going to die. We think players will notice and hit the weak spot because we made it flash reds. We think players will understand the story and understand this player is lying because they'll remember what they learned from the previous scene. From that, you can generate a list of hypotheses about your game. And then this is a thing that you can rank. You could ask your team some questions or ask yourself some questions. Is this hypothesis a core part of experience? Do we need this to work for the game to be successful? is it a thing we're able to make changes to, or is a team not able to make changes and we've moved on and we can't do anything about it? Is this risky? Is it a thing we've done before and we know everything about and there's no risk here? Or is it a thing that we're uncertain about? We've never done this type of thing before. We don't know if it works or not. And from that, you start to prioritize your hypotheses. You get to work out what things do we definitely need to playtest, and what things can we put on the backlog, get to if we have loads of time, but it doesn't matter if we don't get there. And I know this is a production community, so you're experts on how to manage a backlog and how to do it. But whether you're managing your backlog on Jira or Trello or however you approach a backlog management, once you've got that hypothesis log, you can take it into your product management tool and add it to your backlog. One of the most common delays I hear from these teams is we've got to wait until it's ready. We can't test just this feature in isolation. And I think that's not the model that most successful teams use. If you recognize that we can test one of those single hypotheses in the most guerrilla and most easy way possible, we can mock up all the stuff that isn't ready. If it's not relevant to that hypothesis, we can ignore it. We can step in, and if we're moderating these studies, so we're with the players live, we can be the tutorial and we can explain the stuff the tutorial would explain. It's okay, there are bugs, because we can explain how to overcome the bugs, because we're not looking for bugs. When we're focusing on a specific hypothesis, we should be free to mock up all of the things that aren't ready, ignore all of that, and make sure that we don't let that stop us from testing our hypothesis. Again, the issue I see is teams believing they have to wait until they have a vertical slice, or wait until the game's far enough in development. And in real life, often that's much too late to have effective playtests. And I think the ethos I want to promote with the teams I work with is even the smallest test is better than nothing. Just getting two or three people, just doing very informal tasks, like putting them in front of it and seeing if they understand it or see if they can use it, flags, is there a problem here? And yes, that's not a perfect research study. Yes, there's a whole lot more you can do. But just by doing these small activities regularly, once a month, let's say, it flags, here's where the problems are. And you can go and plan a bigger study when you need it, because you've worked out what parts of the game need it and where it's not important. Ultimately, by going through this process, we'll end up with a list of the most important things to playtest, by recognizing our hypotheses, by listing our hypotheses, and by ranking our hypotheses by risk. And as early as possible, we'll recognize when there are critical things that we need to be playtesting as early as possible. So the third thing I'm going to talk about today is making the most of your players' time. That people believe, and fairly, I guess, that playtesting can be difficult. That process I talked about of how do you go and find those playtesters feels like a lot of hassle. Actually running a playtest, creating a build, feels like a big deal, which it is true. And because of that, it's important for us to make the most of that time that we do have with players when we have their time. When I was interviewing the developers about how they approach playtesting and the challenges of playtesting, I asked, okay, how do you currently run your playtests? How do you currently collect your data? And the most common method I heard was, well, I send out a survey and they fill out the survey and I read the survey to see what's good about the game and what's bad about the game. Or we have a Discord channel for playtests and people just put their comments in the Discord channel and I read through the comments every couple of weeks to see what people are saying about our games. Again, I can see why teams do this. It's convenient because it doesn't take a huge amount of effort from us to send out a survey or read a Discord channel, but we're missing a huge amount of valuable data by just relying on those methods. Both of those methods require players to recognize the problems they're having and be able to describe it. That's what we call self-report, where people are self-reporting the problems they have. When people are self-reporting, we're missing a lot of really valuable data about actually what are the players doing in the game? How did they approach the challenges they encountered? Did they miss a feature or a mechanic entirely? Players won't know, so they won't be able to tell you on their survey, I didn't know this existed. But you watching a session we'll see that. Players often don't realise they've misunderstood something. And again, from Discord feedback or from surveys, you're not going to pick up what they haven't understood. And these methods are reported at the end. So you're only getting what their reflection at the end of the playtest session was. You're not seeing their experience throughout. Did they know beforehand that this twist in the story was coming? Or why did it take them a whole bunch of attempts to complete this puzzle? You miss that by only asking questions at the end. So another challenge we have then is, how do we pick the right playtest method? How do we identify what actually should we be doing with our players when we have them? And this comes back to that decision-making process we talked about earlier. Every time a gameplay decision is made, we have a hypothesis. And to answer that hypothesis, we need to match it with the right method. I'll talk about some methods in a second, but making sure that it's the hypothesis that's informing the method is the important part here, rather than just starting by thinking, I'm going to run a survey, or I'm going to do some Discord chat, read some Discord chat. Different methods have different specialties. Some of them are good for learning what players do. Some of them are good for learning why players do that. And some of them are good for players' opinions, what they like or they don't like. But some of the most common methods that you might want to explore include live observation, which is watching players as they play and observing the problems that they have. Pre-recorded observation, where players are sending you a video of their playthrough and you can re-watch their video to see what they thought as they played. Surveys, as we talked about, where players mark the game at the end, they give some ratings, they write what they thought was good or write what they thought was bad. Interviews, where you're actually asking questions live to players to say, what did you think? Why did you think that? Types of things that allow you to probe really deep on the detail of what players are telling you. Or analytics, where the game itself is capturing player behavior and telling you what players are doing. There's a whole bunch of methods there, and each of those would take a much longer session than this to go into in more depth. But I think teams get a huge amount of value just by watching a few people play. Although teams often default to, we're going to run a big survey, we need loads of players, even just watching two or three players play your game, asking them questions as they play to see what their understanding is, what's going through their head, explaining the behavior that you're seeing them doing, I think gives it a much richer form of information and is much more actionable for a team than a survey that 1,000 people have filled out. That's often very hard to translate into action. The setup to do this can also be really simple. Usability labs feel like a high-tech thing, but ultimately you can just do it with a laptop and running obs, for example, to screen record. If you're lucky enough to be doing this live where you're in the same room as a playtester, you can just plug in a second monitor to watch what they're doing. Or you can do all of this remotely. You can set up a Zoom call, watch them play over a Zoom call, or do the same with Google Meet, which is free. Both of these also allow you to record the session, which is really helpful. Or if you're in person, again, you can just hand them a mobile phone or a device. As I mentioned, OBS or Windows Game Bar both allow you to record gameplay and also them talking out loud. And then you get a huge amount of really actionable data that you can use to inform your iteration in your game development. Ultimately, what I've tried to convey here is the importance of matching the method to your playtest goals. What do you want to learn from it and what is your hypothesis? As a rough rule, if you want to measure something like, do players like this, or is it easy or is it hard? These are measurement questions. You'll want to do a survey. If you want to understand what players are doing in your game, you want to watch them play either live or watching pre-recorded footage that they've recorded themselves. Or if you want to understand why they're doing that thing, you want to ask them either, I guess that's most commonly an interview, either after they've played to ask them about it, or asking them questions as they play to understand why they're doing the things they're doing in the game. And all of these methods can be combined. What I've hoped to get from this section is, although teams default to surveys or Discord chats because they're easy, you're leaving a huge amount of data on the table. And actually, you need to be basing your decisions based on what does our team need to know and what are our hypotheses, rather than just taking what's easy. Couple more things I wanted to talk about that we heard from those interviews with game developers about playtesting. One of the challenges that came up a bunch was there's a lot of data from playtests, and how do we take all that raw data, all those observations, and make that into actions and deciding what to do? And it is true, playtests generate a huge amount of data. Depending on your method, you might have players' behavior, things that you saw them do in the game. You might have telemetry or analytics, things the game has reported that players are doing. You might have quantitative survey ratings, where you've asked players to rate different bits of the game. You might have qualitative comments, where people have said things about the game or written a survey response to what they think about the game. You might have interview data, where you've asked some questions about the game. And that can seem overwhelming. That's a huge amount of information to deal with. And so I want to talk about, how do you deal with that playtest data? The first step is always to go back to, why are we running this playtest? What was the focus of our playtest and what were we trying to learn? And again, on the, I'll share the checklist first at the end of the session, but that first step is usually, let's decide the focus of our playtest. What do we want to learn from playtesting today? And this is a great point, once you've got all your data, to remind yourself of that so you don't get distracted. From that data, you want to treat different types of data differently. Some of that data is going to be things that players did, what I'm going to call behavior data for the moment, and other things are going to be players' opinions or players' comments about the game, and that's going to be opinion data, what do players think about the game. And we're going to talk about how to treat each of those differently. First of all, that behavior data. Behavior data is great. And as a user researcher, a lot of our focus is on players' behavior, what they do in the game, where they got lost, where they didn't see where they were meant to go, what they didn't understand, is all stuff that players did or didn't do. Behavior data is objective. We saw that happen. We know that player got lost. And because it's objective, it's a truth, it's the safest to take action on. Some examples of the type of thing this might look like. We might have observed a player failed to find where they should be spending their in-game currency because they didn't see the correct menu option. Or we observed that players wandered the wrong way on the level because they didn't see the door. These are things that definitely happened and things that we can take action on. The steps to take action on them are reasonably simple. First of all, we need to understand why it happened. So a look back either at our notes or our videos, or reflect on what did we see that caused that issue to occur. And that's always something about the game. What is it about the game that caused that issue to occur? Then we need to decide what's the appropriate fix to that. And we'll talk about fixes in the last section, but work out, okay, we know there's an issue. It objectively happened. What are we going to do about this issue? And then prioritize that fix. And again, talking to the game production community today, you are experts on prioritization of fixing usability issues versus other things. Behavior data, really simple to action because we know it's true. The trickier one, and the one where I see teams go wrong more often, is opinion data. That's when players have told you what they think about the game. They've said, this enemy is annoying because he's really difficult, or this game would be better if you had a different feature, for example, a shotgun in this example, angry Candy Crush player there. There are extra steps when you're dealing with opinion data. So we can't just go and do what players tell us we should do, because players aren't experts at game design. We, as game developers, are the experts on game design. Players don't have enough context to give good suggestions. They don't know what's feasible in the engine. They don't have expertise in design or UX or game development. They don't know what's feasible in the timelines we have, or what's feasible, what have we tried before, what iterations have occurred previously that have led the team to this decision they made today. Because players don't give good suggestions and their feedback is more risky, we need to take some extra steps. First of all, we need to understand what happened in that session that led to players giving that feedback. Again, that looks like remembering what you saw in the session, or looking back at your notes, or watching the video again to remember why that feedback, or work out why that feedback occurred. And then you need to think about, is that the experience we want to make? Some games are meant to be hard. You can't, if you're making Bloodborne or Elden Ring, something like that, just because players say this is hard doesn't necessarily mean that we need to make a change. we need to reflect on what is the designer's intent and what's this game trying to achieve before we decide if it's even worth fixing this issue or not, or is this just what we're intended to make. That means we can then decide if action is appropriate, and again, this community is an expert at this, we can then work out how important is it to fix this issue. We'll talk about how to fix or an approach for fixing issues in a second. Ultimately, the advice that I have for game developers in this space is don't forget that you're the expert. It can be really easy to get down a rabbit hole because players are telling you to make changes, to start making those changes that players raise. And that is that's often a mistake. Because players don't have your expertise, they don't have your context, they won't be able to come up with good suggestions. They can just tell you there's a problem here. You then want to ignore their suggestion, go back to the root of that problem and understand why that problem potentially exists, and use your design and development expertise to go forward into actually making the change. So the last thing I wanted to talk about today was deciding what to do next. And one of the challenges is, okay, we've learned this problem with our game. What do we want to do? How do we decide whether we're going to do something about it? First thing to think about is, what was the impact on the player for this issue? Again, from a playtest, you'll have some observations or you have some comments that will be able to tell us what the impact on the player experience was. Was it players got lost, but they quickly found where they were meant to go, and because of that, there wasn't a long-term problem? That's okay. That's not a huge priority to fix. Is it players got lost, and then because of that, they never finished the level? That's obviously much more significant. And although I don't cover it in this session today, user researchers have a series of criteria that we go through, and I can share if someone asks on Twitter after how we assess whether this is a significant issue or not. From that, you can work out your most significant issues and then decide how to fix it. I know everyone usually groans when we talk about ideation and workshops and collaboration, but there are a lot of benefits to having facilitated ideation workshops where you can bring in all these disciplines to look at a complete fix. What that might look like is going through individual thinking where everyone thinks about their individual expertise about how to fix this issue, some sort of group reflection, and then as a group deciding what the ultimate solution is on how to fix that game. But regardless, you want to work out as a team, how do we fix that issue? And I personally, as a user researcher, often like working with teams to run that type of ideation, help them get to the right solution for their game. Obviously, that's only possible for larger teams where there's more than one person. If you're a solo developer, you have to ideate all by yourself. Prioritization. Again, I appreciate everyone on this call is the expert on prioritization, but some of the things that as a researcher we might recommend thinking about is, we've thought about the impact on the player. We've got a rating, whether it's a low issue or a high issue, for the impact on the player. And then comparing that to effort. How much effort would it be to fix this? And then plotting that can quickly reveal, here's the most important fixes, and that can be taken into your backlog to take forwards. But ultimately, I hope that some of what we've talked about helps overcome some of the issues that we see from playtesting. Iteration, as we flagged at the beginning, is key to the game development process and is the way that you can get to high quality games. It's the more iterations you can do. Playtesting is an ingredient for iteration, some fuel or some inspiration for what you might want to do. And because of that, I think the more playtests we can run, even if they're that lo-fi, guerrilla, mocked up playtest rather than a big 1,000 player survey, gets us more iterations and closer to a higher quality game. The last thing I want to leave you with was a few tools or things that can help. So what I hope the message, or I hope one of the messages I've talked about today, is that playtesting doesn't have to be a big deal. And one of the barriers that we hear from game teams is just playtesting seems like too much effort to be worth doing it. And I appreciate that. I appreciate that game development is a very time-pressured environment. It's hard to prioritize things. And I hope some of the techniques we've talked about at least get you a step towards playtesting being a lower effort activity and easier to do. Some of the the vague shape of the steps that I think teams should be thinking about. It's just thinking about what you want to learn from your playtest, making pragmatic decisions about how to gather that data. It doesn't always have to be a big playtest. It can just be, let's put it in front of three people and see what happens. Interpreting that data correctly and prioritizing it so you're focused on the most important things, and then making a sensible decision on what to do about the issues you've seen. I think, and some of the teams I work with have recognized that, yes, it's not the full user research process you get with a user researcher, but as a push, you can fit a lot of this into just a single day. And hopefully it's not a huge commitment to try and do a single day of playtesting every month or every 2 months to increase the number of iterations you go through and to help make games better. Sometimes playtesting can be more complicated, and there are things you might want to do, like look at retention studies when people drop off over months of play, or you might want to do massive multi-seat playtests where you're getting 80 people to play at the same time together, when you might want to call in specialists, and that's cool. As I mentioned at the beginning, I wrote that book about how to do this as a specialist job, how to be a games user researcher. And there's also a very active games research community of consultants and agencies who can help out. I think I linked to them on the gamesuserresearch.com website, but also if you're ever looking for a consultant, I can put you in touch with people if you're interested. Why I'm talking about this today is because, as I flagged at the beginning, playtesting doesn't have to be a big deal, but I recognize there are a huge amount of barriers for normal game developers who aren't doing user research full-time that make it hard. And some of the things that can help are tools and templates, and the playtest kit that I launched earlier this year aims to do that. It aims to be, here are the tools and templates to get you started so that playtesting isn't a big problem. The playtest kit hopefully is a repeatable playtest process and just lets you get started with this. I'm not going to do too much of an advert. Lots of nice people said nice things about it, about, hey, it's like having a consultant. It makes game development easier. It's practical. It's useful. It's a thing for game developers, not for user research specialists. And if it's a thing you're interested in, the website is playtestkit.com. I mentioned that checklist. There's a place you can sign up on there to get that playtesting checklist. If you decide you're interested in this, and thank you for listening for the last hour, you can get a discount with the code GAMEPRODUCTION, which is just for this community. But regardless of your interest in the playtest kit, I am really enthusiastic about playtesting. I love talking about it. I love the challenges of it and helping people get better at playtesting. I'm really active on Twitter if you want to follow about playtesting and talk about playtesting, or just drop me an email and I'll know about playtesting. But I'm just going to end on saying thank you. Thank you for taking the time to listen today, for hearing a bit about playtesting and some of the best practice. And I think we have a little bit of time for questions. So thank you very much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
And thank you so much, Steve. It's kind of fascinating how hearing you share all of these learnings out loud adds another layer of depth. Of course, I've read the material and I've been doing playtests for a long time, and yet listening to you talk about it still triggers new thoughts in my head. So it's like new bits on top of reading the theory. And that does lead me to a full disclosure note that I was one of those people that was humbly invited to review the playtest kit prior to launch. And I have to say, I was quite genuine when I wrote that I wish I had this kit when I first started designing interactive experiences a very, very long time ago. So I would strongly recommend it myself. In the meantime, we've got questions coming in the event QA channel. For everyone listening, please add your questions there. And of course, vote for questions that were posted by others to increase the chance of having it answered. We may not be able to get around to everything, but we'll take a stab at it. First up, just super practically, Steve, will the slides be available publicly after the
talk? Yes. Yeah, I don't know the best way to share it with the community, but no problem with sharing the slides. I'll follow up with you after Junie and say, here they are, and then you can share them if you're comfortable doing so.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll make sure to share that together with the recording. All right. In that case, moving on to questions that were posted by community members, and I see them all trickling in now. How much information should we divulge to a tester before they do the playtest?
That's a great question. And the answer to any sort of user research question and UX question is it depends. I think the root of it is start by thinking about what are we trying to learn from this playtest? What are our objectives? And then from that, what do we need players to have understood beforehand? So, for example, they might be skipping a tutorial. We need to tell them the stuff in the tutorial. But also, what do we need to not reveal to players? If we're interested in seeing if they understand how to craft an item, we need to be really careful with how we ask players to do that so that we don't reveal where the item is or how to craft it or what menu crafting is under. What's a nice generic answer to the question? I guess you want to divulge the minimum possible to avoid revealing information the player wouldn't naturally have, but also making sure you are covering off stuff that the players would know in real life. What would they have got from the tutorial? What would they have seen earlier in the game? And as long as you're not trying to learn about the tutorial, that type of thing should be fine.
So we have a few questions that I can try to group together a little bit. You've mentioned how finding that a lot of folks that you spoke to reported that finding playtesters is pretty challenging. But what we will also necessarily wonder at that point, like, are there pros and cons to asking the same testers to test when you're doing different iterations? Or would it be beneficial to have new players each time, especially in a scenario with, for example, a game that's a one-time experience?
Yes, I'm going to try really hard not to answer it, depend on it, to every question. But the nice thing about the panel is you do keep those players. If you've signed them up to take part in playtests and to be contacted about playtests, you can email them again and get them to take part in your playtests again. It depends on what you want to learn from your playtests. So if your objectives are around long-term playing and opinions and those type of things, yes, you may get those same people back, but there are some things that you just can't learn from bringing the same player back again. If you're interested in, do players understand this, or will they learn it from the tutorial, you can only use that player once, because after they've gone through your tutorial, even if they had some issues, the next time you show them it, they won't be a genuine player. They'll have all that pre-information from the last time they playtested. So again, I guess it's reflecting on what do we want to learn from this study? Do we need new players to answer that? Or is it okay to have a player come back? And usually if you're looking at understanding and players' understanding of what they're doing, or teaching players how to do things, you will want new players. Otherwise, sometimes it can be okay to use the same players again, which is very useful when we've got that panel of playtesters ready to go.
And on time, Steve, do you mind running a couple minutes over for a few more questions?
Yeah, I'm good too.
Okay, great. So then Maxim asks, with regards to GDPR regulations, are there any serious concerns to take in mind when establishing a mailing list and, for example, collecting and processing data from players?
That's a really good point. And what I quite like about MailChimp and ConvertKit, the ones I mentioned, is they do handle a lot of that for you because they are mailing list providers and they have to deal with GDPR and personal data handling. All the things about users being able to remove their consent, users understanding why they're on that list, they do a lot of the heavy lifting to make sure that's covered and looked after. I guess it's always useful to be aware of GDPR. I don't know if everyone's aware. GDPR is a European legislation about keeping people's personal data. It's always useful to be aware of those things because there are risks of keeping data that you don't need or you're not going to do anything with. But the nice thing about using an established mailing list provider is they've also thought about this and handle it for you, compared to if you just kept your own Excel spreadsheet of playtesters, you're much more likely to fall foul of we're keeping the data in an inappropriate way or keeping inappropriate information, or we're not allowing people to revoke access to their data. yeah, so mailing lists help with that.
Right, great. Raghu from Alcotech Labs asks, how do you make sure that the NDAs are enforced and respected when going for a playtest?
Oh, that's a great question. And not to make it too much of an advert, on gamedusersresearch.com, there's a bit that says free lessons. And just this week, we did one about preventing leaks and keeping games secret. So there's a couple of aspects of this, though. Obviously, starting with getting people to sign an NDA, and also if you are doing live playtests, reiterating that with them, making sure you talk through this is what it means and this is why it's important. And remembering at the end of the session to reiterate that and say again, you signed the NDA, remember that. What some other techniques to think about? There's a link in that free lesson to a talk by Bob Tilford, who's now at Rockstar Games. He talks about the value of building rapport and being friendly with your playtesters helps prevent them from breaking NDAs or doing secret things. Also, there's a whole bunch of code things you can do. You can start to watermark your builds. You can start to do things like not sending them a build directly, streaming it through something like Parsec to reduce their access to builds, or bringing people to playtest live with you and taking away their phones so they can't take pictures. Ultimately, leaks may happen, and that is a risk that as user researchers we need to be very aware of. Because of that, we need to be careful about picking the right methods, the most secure methods, and doing things like making sure NDAs are well understood and our players understand why it's important to us to enforce them. If you're interested in more information, that email lesson, the free lessons on keeping games secret, is on the gamesuserresearch.com website and talks more about this topic.
And if I can add a little bit to that from personal experience, what I've also found is a lot of playtesters are not aware that leaking can actually damage the rest of your game development process and your sales and the continuity for your business. And often playtesters are very passionate and eager to talk about your product because they care about you as a developer, because they care about your game. And that means that if they don't realize that it can hurt you, that's also something that it helps pointing out to them. Because in that way, you make it also clear why that NDA is important. And instead, you could also channel all of that passion and energy that they feel about talking about your game into, for example, a private Discord server where you have gathered your playtesters for example, doing something with that mailing list to make sure that they have an outlet for where to put that energy and passion. I don't know, really, Steve, maybe you totally disagree with that, but that's what I've found personally.
No, I think that's a fantastic point and really good experience. Thank you for sharing.
Then Nat asks, how do you feel about using the how might we framework for ideating solutions once you identify issues?
Oh, I'm a huge fan of how might we's. They can, I guess, those type of ideation sessions need to be actively facilitated. And for a lot of people who are further away from design disciplines, they might not immediately be familiar with how might we's or see how they should be used. And so you'll need to introduce it and give some examples, but it is my preferred way of prompting. Just for the wider group, not everyone might be familiar, one of the ways that you might address fixing problems in the game is setting a team a prompt. How might we help players realize where they're meant to go? That kind of thinking helps encourage recognizing there's not just one potential solution, there's 100 different ways you could address that issue, and working through a process to reflect and refine those ideas, I think is really valuable. So yeah, big fan of how might we's.
Yeah, I want to sneak in a question of my own, because we are, of course, in a production Discord, and something that I've struggled with a little bit myself is that I've occasionally not really felt I wasn't sure how much time it was worth spending sum total on any given playtest. So when did the return on investment start diminishing, both in time and money? Like you're investing a lot of people hours into this, and that's not cheap. That's hours that they can't spend developing. So any advice on assessing how much time you should be spending?
I think that's a good point. So at the beginning of the talk, we talked about ranking the risk of your hypotheses. And so I guess that allows you to focus on, to identify, yes, this is really important to the success of the game, so it requires a lot of time, versus here's a whole bunch of low priority hypotheses. It's not that important. If they don't work, we shouldn't give that much time to it. I don't have a definitive answer to this, but I think that process of ranking both before you start, how important is it we playtest this thing? And then you could do a similar thing when you've got the results at the other side. You could look at the severity of the issues and then decide, okay, there's a whole bunch of critical issues here. We need to put a bunch of attention into this, versus we've only got some low priority issues. These are nice to have, but when stacked up against all the other production tasks we need to do, this isn't the biggest deal. So I guess it is go through that process of ranking and prioritizing that this community will do so well.
Ruan asks, how do you find the process differs across platforms? So for example, desktop versus mobile. That's a very broad question, but just some highlights maybe.
Yeah, I guess the main difference on different platforms is the methods we have available to us. Another difference is the type of research objectives. If you're working on a mobile game, the context of play, where people are playing, is much more important than it is on console. On console, you can assume someone's sat in front of their TV and it's got their full attention. Mobile games, I'd want to understand more about where do they play and how does that fit into their life and how long do they have to play. But the real implication, I guess, is on the method. Some of the methods we talked about, like live observation, is really easy to do live if you bring them to you for a lot of these platforms. Really difficult to do remotely. It's very hard to get someone to do it's not impossible, Parsec exists, but getting someone to playtest a console game from their home is a technical challenge beyond what we've talked about today. Similar for mobile, there's some technical implications on how do we get the build to them? How do we make sure that they're recording on their mobile and can record what happens? So I think it does influence your method choice, but the process we talked about of understanding your objectives, decide the right method based on the constraints you have, gather data and deal with data is the same regardless of your platform or what you're testing.
Would you say there are similar kinds of differences when testing different genres? Are there highlights there to come?
That's a good question too. I think the difference on genre is often about what teams want to know from their game. The most significant difference, I guess I see, is if you're working on a mobile game, especially a free-to-play mobile game, you're tremendously interested in retention and keeping people for 30 days, for example. That means the type of study you want to learn and how you want to approach that is completely different from other genres where, again, thinking about a boxed console game, the type of thing that people want to know are usually, do people understand where they're meant to go? Do they understand what they're meant to do? Do they understand the mechanics in the game? So I think it influences your research objectives and what you hope to learn from a playtest. It's an interesting topic, though.
And then another question, is it okay to do an A/B playtest, or would that just be confusing?
Oh, sorry, could you repeat the question? What type of playtest?
An A/B test, so playtesting, but then with multiple different variables.
Yeah, fantastic. That wasn't one of the methods I talked about, but it definitely is a playtest method that exists. So half the players see one version, half the players see the other version. A couple of thoughts on that. I guess it's very relevant for mobile games in particular, because they're closest to traditional tech development. It does often introduce challenges, because often with an A/B test, what you're trying to learn is measuring things. You want to measure, do players spend longer in the game on this version versus that version, or do players rate the game higher on this version versus the other version? And that's a quantitative question. You need to see a lot of players before you can get statistically significant answers to that. But again, sometimes that's the right method for the type of objectives you have. One challenge, I think, again, with A/B testing is when you're running them, you've pre-thought about two different solutions and you think, okay, it's either going to be this one or that one. And sometimes that can be a bit limiting because it is a method where you don't see players play for real. You're not asking players questions. You sometimes lack the ability to get that outside inspiration from, okay, we thought the problem was between these two versions, but actually when we listen to players, they're talking about something completely different and our major issues are somewhere completely different. So I think it can lead to too much focus, but again, combined with other playtest methods to mitigate that, it's a really important tool to have in your toolkit.
And this question was a little bit longer, but a few of these questions were already answered earlier in the talk. So I would recommend the person who asked them listen back to the start. But there was one particular question in between that I'm also super interested in myself is, do you feel that cultural differences play a role in the approach that playtesters take?
I think that's a really important topic, and definitely yes. So an example of this is during my time at PlayStation. Our team was based in London. We test primarily with European players. There were equivalent teams in San Francisco and equivalent teams in Japan. I don't know a huge amount about Japanese culture, but the approaches that their research team had to take were significantly different from our approaches. I've heard, again, I don't know how true this is, that it's culturally a lot more difficult to give direct negative feedback, for example, in Japan than it would be in Europe or in America. And because of that, some of the methods we would use, like asking people what's the worst thing about the game, just wouldn't be productive. So yes, I think cultural differences do exist with players and also with players' willingness to give feedback or how they approach feedback. Again, that's probably an important thing to recruit on. If your game, if it's relevant to a variety of cultural backgrounds, making sure you're recruiting players from those backgrounds and then handling that feedback in an appropriate way for that culture is probably an important part of that process. That was a long answer, but I think yes, the answer is yes. Cultural differences do exist, and we need to be aware of them when designing and running playtests.
I honestly wouldn't expect otherwise. I mean, it matters so much within game development that it would be strange if it didn't matter in the playtests that we run. We're close to wrapping up. So I'm going to be a little picky with the questions that I'm doing last. Is it okay to automate/generate logs during playtests to find more information about the process that players follow, or do you feel that's too specific?
Oh, no, I think that's great. And people have probably seen there's talks from Naughty Dog about how they've approached that, or talks from Bungie about how they've approached that. Again, the important thing to do is start with what do I want to learn from this playtest. Sometimes that type of analytics or telemetry where the game is measuring player behavior is the right way to answer that. But we need to start by reflecting on what's our hypothesis, what data do we need to see if it's working or not working, and then use that to decide, should we be observing players? Should we be sending them a survey? Should the game be tracking their behavior? And then make that decision based on the hypothesis. But yes, I think it's a really important method. There's a good book, I'm not going to remember the name of the book now. There's a book that came out last year by Oxford University Press. I think it's called Game Data and Analytics, something like that, which is a great resource for learning more if it's a thing people are interested in.
Oh, I think I was unmuted while I was typing. That was not the intention. All right, so wrapping this up with a final question, you've of course listed your Twitter and your email address, but a question came in if you have a LinkedIn account, and if so, if you would be okay with being reached out to via LinkedIn as well.
Oh, yes, of course. Any way that you can find me, do connect. I'm on LinkedIn. I can't recall what my LinkedIn ID is, but it's the same picture as on this call. Follow me on Twitter. Send me emails with questions about playtesting. I'll talk about playtesting endlessly. I send out every month that email playtesting lessons. Sign up for the emails of playtesting lessons. Do keep in touch. I love talking about playtesting.
All right. And with that, we are wrapping up. Thank you so much, Steve. That was incredibly insightful. I would, of course, also like to thank our supporters and, again, our event producer, Angelo. Without all of you, this wouldn't have been made possible. And as mentioned before, this was recorded, and we're going to publish the recording on the Game Production Podcast as soon as we're able. And we'll, of course, include a link to the slides. Thank you again, everyone.
Thank you very much.